Author's note. Writing for Alex Jones. I grew up in what I continue to believe to this day is the single most beautiful spot on the face of the earth. We lived just off the 14th hole at Round Hill Country Club in Alamo, California, about 35 miles east of San Francisco. The 14th hole is a long par 5, dogleg right, with a duck pond and an overhanging oak tree about 130 yards from the green. In about 30 steps, I could walk from my backyard and be standing on the banks of the pond with some bread to feed the ducks. Round Hill was just a few years old when we moved there in 1965, and it had the energy and brashness of new money, populated by creative thinkers who'd figured out how to grab an outsized share of the American dream. Directly across from my house on the other side of the 14th hole, they built a 12,000-square-foot mansion, at the time the largest house in the county. The owner had a popular restaurant, The Elegant Farmer, on the waterfront at Jack London Square in Oakland. I often played at that house, always pausing when I entered their front door to look at the enormous 8-foot-tall stuffed polar bear just inside the entrance. I understand that in many ways, I did not have a typical American childhood. At various times in my life, I could have been talking at a party with baseball legend Joe DiMaggio, or star basketball player for the Golden State Warriors, and one-time NBA record holder for best career free throw percentage Rick Barry, being wished happy birthday on the radio by the Bay Area's most popular AM disc jockey, Dr. Don Rose, throwing a football around with various members of the Oakland Raiders, playing a few holes with professional golfers like Johnny Jacobs or Ron Cummins, or blowing off fireworks on the 4th of July with Marvin Starr, who wrote the definitive textbook on California real estate law. If my parents had died when I was young, I would have been taken care of by Angelo Sangiacomo, at the time the largest landowner in San Francisco. I got to see a lot of famous and controversial people up close when I was young, and they fascinated me as much as the books I constantly devoured. My parents had a similar curiosity about the people who populated our neighborhood, as well as the greater world. My parents met at the 1956 Republican Convention in San Francisco, and although we were Republican, my father was always open to different ideas. I have vivid memories of people talking with him about social icons or political figures, and my father saying, "I don't know much about him, her. What do you like about them?" He'd listen to what they had to say, usually thanking them for providing their point of view. Once, after the person left, I said, "You hate the guy he was describing. Why did you listen to him go on and on about that guy?" My father shrugged and said, "Maybe I'll learn something. What does it cost me to listen?" Which is why, when one of my father's friends suggested he donate to Democratic U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer's campaign as a way to go to some great parties, he jumped at the chance. My father, mother, and I went to several of these parties, where I got to meet then-Senator Boxer, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, and I'm assuming the current Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also there. Around that time, I'd been working as a summer intern for Republican U.S. Senator Pete Wilson. Wilson and Feinstein had been working closely together on some California issues, and there was a great mutual respect and fondness between the two. I remember having a nice conversation of a few minutes with Senator Feinstein at one of these events, and saying to her, "You should be the first woman president of our country. Why don't you run?" I may have been a Republican, but I also recognized accomplishment. She'd done a great job taking over as mayor of San Francisco after the assassination of Mayor George Moscone, and had been a reasonable Democrat in the Senate, committed to working across the aisle when she could. She thanked me for my words, but didn't really give me an answer. After that, I remember going up to my parents, as well as Angelo Sangiacomo, my de facto godfather, and saying, "I don't know why Senator Feinstein doesn't run for president." "She's got a China problem," said Angelo. "Her husband's made a lot of money with the communists. That wouldn't fly in a national election." When her husband, Richard Bloom, died in 2022, their estate was valued at $1 billion. The two had been married since 1980. I tell you this story to let you know that when I saw something positive about a politician from the other side of the aisle, I would admit it. However, I also tell this story as a warning that you may not know critical facts about a public figure. Be friendly and open to the good, but also retain some skepticism. A 1997 article from the Los Angeles Times detailed this potential conflict of Feinstein arguing for better U.S.-China relations while her husband was doing deals with the rising communist superpower. On Capitol Hill, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, has emerged as one of the staunchest proponents of closer U.S. relations with China, fighting for permanent most favored nation trading status for Beijing. At the same time, far from the spotlight, Feinstein's husband, Richard C. Bloom, has expanded his private business interests in China, to the point that his firm is now a prominent investor inside the communist nation. To this day, I remain confused as to why more investigation was not made of this potential conflict of interest. In 2018, it was revealed by CBS News that Senator Feinstein had employed a Chinese spy in her Senate office for 20 years. New details emerged Wednesday about how a mole for the government of Communist China managed to stay by Senator Dianne Feinstein's side for nearly 20 years. The column revealed that the Chinese spy was Feinstein's driver, who also served as a gopher in her Bay Area office and was a liaison to the Asian American community. He even attended Chinese consulate functions for the senator. Feinstein, who was chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time, was reportedly mortified when the FBI told her she'd been infiltrated. When the story broke in the news, I recalled what I'd heard from Angelo in the early 1990s. Might there be any connection between Feinstein's husband doing deals with the communist Chinese and the placement of a Chinese spy in Feinstein's office? That remains a mystery to me for which I have no answer. But I have my suspicions. When I was young, I wanted to be a criminal prosecutor, a crusader, almost like Elliot Ness in Chicago taking on Al Capone, or Rudy Giuliani, who'd been so effective at dismantling the New York Mafia. But I was also fascinated by the criminal defense attorneys, people like F. Lee Bailey, William Kunstler, Alan Dershowitz, and Jerry Spence. They seemed to be the single individual standing up to an entire system. And although I thought they were often wrong, I admired their courage. What must it feel like to confront the awesome power of the state and disapproval of the public, using only your intelligence and powers of persuasion? I love the example of Atticus Finch, as portrayed by Gregory Peck in the classic movie To Kill a Mockingbird, as an example of standing up for principle against prejudice. In law school, I was fortunate enough to take several classes with the famed criminal defense attorney Bernie Siegel, who had defended Jeffrey McDonald, the so-called Green Beret killer, an army surgeon who was charged and, according to Bernie, unfairly convicted of murdering his wife and family. McDonald always maintained the murders had been committed by a group of hippies, including a woman named Helena Steckley, a local drug addict, who repeatedly confessed to, and later recanted, her participation in the murders. for 2 summers while in law school, I worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. 1 summer assembling wiretap evidence against Oakland drug kingpin Rudy Henderson, and the 2nd summer bringing misdemeanor cases in federal court. I recall my younger self, the very model of a country club conservative, hanging out with my fellow legal eagles in training at the cafeteria, when in walked our greatest nemesis, Tony Serra, the famed criminal defense attorney on the other side of the government's war on drugs. Serra was a remarkable specimen to be walking around the federal courthouse in the late 1980s. Tall, broad-shouldered like a linebacker, maybe in his early 50s, with long white hair cascading well past his shoulders, as if he'd kept his 1960s hairstyle as a protest against the conservative times. We'd heard lurid stories about Serra's exploits. He thought pot should be legal, hung out with drug dealers, and often had parties late into the night at his law firm with his criminal clients with loud music, wild dancing, and, of course, lots of drugs. One of Tony Serra's cases was portrayed in a bad 1980s movie called True Believer, in which he was played by the actor James Woods. When the movie came out and Tony was asked if the movie was an accurate portrayal of him, he said something along the lines of, "I smoke a joint in the opening scene of the movie, and that's the only thing they got right about me." Tony Serra was a wild man to us, and yet on that day, he had his daughter with him, who appeared to be all of 9 or 10 years old. I watched how tender he was with his young daughter, helping her with her food tray, listening to her, talking and laughing, and found myself thinking, is he really the bad guy? Maybe we're the bad guys, the people sitting with me, shooting dirty looks at him, and muttering insults under our breath. I have a daughter now, vaccine injured, who requires daily cannabis to keep her from having devastating seizures. And I can't help but think to myself, how many things have I been wrong about? I was certainly wrong about marijuana, although I'm still so much of a straight arrow that I've never smoked pot. Old habits die hard. However, by the same token, I've never been drunk, even though I'm part owner of a prestigious vineyard in the Napa Valley. And I don't disagree with people who say alcohol has caused more problems in the world than pot ever has. At the time I was in law school, one of the big issues Professor Bernie Siegel talked about was the government having the power to seize the assets of alleged drug dealers. He believed this to be an unconstitutional power grab by the federal government, designed to prevent suspects from being able to pay their lawyers. I disagreed with him at the time, but now I realize I was wrong. One can never countenance injustice against any group of people, regardless of how much you may dislike them. Eventually, the government will seek to do the same to others. After the 9/11 attacks, I supported the Patriot Act. The revelations of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange made me change my mind, and I considered the continuing legal assault on them to be a sign that, in many ways, our country has become dictatorial. I considered the Iraq War to be a good thing in 2003. After all, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. The world would be better off without him. But after seeing the disarray we caused in the Middle East, I came to believe I was wrong. I thought vaccines were a great scientific advance, and that any parent who didn't give them to their child should have their head examined. Now, I believe that vaccines and the pharmaceutical companies that make them, free from any financial liability for harm caused by their products, pose an existential risk to humanity. I've been wrong about a lot of things in my life. Maybe you feel the same way, and like me, you're trying to do better. There are many things I've done that I believe I got right, and those fill me with pride. I'm proud of the 4 books I've co-authored with Dr. Judy Mikovits. I'm proud of having written the opening narration for the 26-minute Plandemic video with Dr. Mikovits and Mickey Willis, the most viewed and banned piece of film in history. I'm proud of the 4 books I've co-authored with Project Veritas Whistleblowers. I'm proud of the book I wrote on the revelations of senior CDC scientist Dr. William Thompson, based on documents I received from the office of U.S. Congressman William Posey that reported earlier administration of the MMR vaccine was resulting in high numbers of autism in children, particularly among African American boys. This constitutes, in my opinion, the greatest assault on the black community since the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. I'm proud of the book I wrote with longtime university professor Dr. Joseph Cummins, The Case for Interferon, which detailed the 40-year history of this overlooked immune modulator and cancer treatment that received a special commendation from the prestigious Kirkus Reviews. Despite the controversial nature of the 12 books I've published, 4 have received positive reviews from Kirkus. I'm proud of the 2 books I've worked on with Alex Jones, the most persecuted man on the planet, with $1.5 billion in fines hanging over his head because of views he expressed on his InfoWars show. I don't remember the New York Times getting punished in a similar manner for promoting the Iraq War or for failing to warn the public of potential health risks from childhood vaccines or the COVID-19 shots. I wear as a badge of honor that my scheduled April 9, 2015 talk with Dr. Judy Mikovits and Dr. Brian Hooker at the Commonwealth Club, titled American Whistleblowers, The Promise and Peril of Science, was canceled because of protests and never rescheduled. I will forever be proud of being banned from speaking about vaccines in Australia from August 2017 to August 2020, becoming, to the best of my understanding, the only living American writer banned from an entire continent. I am beyond amused that on his May 17, 2020 broadcast, Chuck Todd devoted an entire 5 minutes of his show, Meet the Press, to trashing my book with Dr. Mikovits, Plague of Corruption, as well as the 26-minute Plandemic video, without mentioning the name of the book or the authors. That must be a first in television history. How can I do anything but laugh at the fact that Amazon delisted my August 2020 book with Dr. Judy Mikovits, The Case Against Masks, which featured a wonderful satirical cartoon cover by renegade cartoonist Ben Garrison of the Statue of Liberty suffocating behind a cloth mask. When my agent presented this project to me and said I'd be working with Alex Jones, I jumped at the opportunity. What self-respecting writer wouldn't want to take on such a controversial subject and see where it led? I recalled the criminal defense attorneys I'd been fascinated with as a kid and thought, yeah, this is something they would do. They wouldn't be scared off by $1.5 billion in fines and the pearl-clutching terror of the mainstream establishment. If anything, they'd eat it up like Joe Biden attacking an ice cream cone. There must always be a place in our society for the fearless, even if they're sometimes mistaken. It's been great working with Alex. He's a wonderful collaborator with a brilliant, almost photographic memory. I've taken to calling myself his bird dog, the hound who accompanies his master on a hunt and then, when the master fires his shotgun, races off into the tall grass to retrieve what was hit. However, instead of bringing back game, I'm chasing down stories Alex remembers or confirming narratives he's developed over decades in the business. 95% of the time, I've found his recollections to be dead on. For most of the remaining 5%, the sources I found didn't rise to a level I considered to be credible, and thus I didn't include them. I can't recall a single instance when he told me something for which I couldn't find any information. I've seen Alex when he's angry, happy, and jovial, or overcome with strong emotion and close to tears. He's a man who cares deeply about the world, as well as other people. The person you see on the show is pretty much the same person I've seen behind the scenes. Amidst the frenzy of putting out a daily show, he has remarkable social intelligence, pushing his production team to be their best, while also giving very specific praise for their good work. He's a man of enormous personal kindness, which is a trait I greatly admire. I hope you'll be enlightened by what Alex had envisioned as a deep dive into many controversial topics that occupy his mind. More than anything else, Alex wanted this to be an optimistic book, giving people hope for a new renaissance of humanity, with God at the center of that glorious future. It has been my great pleasure to assist Alex in turning that vision into reality. I hope to see you somewhere down that road and have a conversation about one of these topics. After all, friendly conversation and debate are the American way. Kent Heckenlively.